but the humans tended to scurry around, popping up here and there. They had no spirit. Hecabe's warriors had done well. They had taken a large circular section on the border of the human city and secured it. Streets had been barricaded at the edges Hecabe designated, and gun platforms rocketed overhead to provide full fire support. Meanwhile, his massive cruiser had started demolishing the buildings and the ground with its plasma batteries, while thousands of Ungoy thralls toiled with machines, heavy excavation platforms like scarabs, locusts, and even their own bare hands, to push rubble toward the edges of the now-occupied Jerahanai areas of the city. Hecabe stood on the crater's rim, towering above the site on the piles of rubble at the perimeter, and watched the massive destruction of the city with eager satisfaction. But the crack of human weapons kept distracting him. The gunfire was getting closer.
"Cretus! A Nexus!" Hecabe shouted. "What are the humans trying to do beyond the barricades? Is this their counterattack?"
Judging by the sounds of the melee from the buildings near the occupied rim, just a couple of streets away from Hecabe, it seemed like a small one indeed.
"It might be only a first wave," a Nexus said.
"We can call the ship to our aid, or fall back to our artillery."
Hecabe stared at a Nexus. What foolishness was a Nexus talking about?
"The ship continues to blast the ground for the slaves and their overseers. You want to divert it for a smattering of humans?"
The Nexus thought about that for a moment.
"They should not stop digging?"
Hecabe considered killing a Nexus on the spot.
"No, they should not stop. No matter how many humans worm back out of their hiding places." "But there are many humans in this city," a Nexus said.
Hecabe laughed and picked up Oath of Fury, his gravity hammer.
"Then let us go and call their numbers, so that they are not such a burden for you, a Nexus. Follow me. If you are a true Jerahanai, and not frightened of these weak little aliens."
Cretus roared in response and grabbed his weapons. Less enthusiastically, a Nexus followed. Hearing the battle cry, Jerahanai warriors turned and saw the three of them running down the pile of rubble and toward the barricades. They joined the rush behind the wedge that Hecabe, Cretus, and a Nexus now made. The enemy gunfire increased, bullets pinging against nearby walls. Hecabe could see glimpses of human squads in the alleyways across the roads from the barricades. They were sneaking around, trying to snipe at the Jerahanai emplacements.
"Get across there and destroy them," Hecabe ordered as he clambered over one of the barricades made of rubble.
Across the intersection, the humans maneuvered to keep a steady stream of fire on small groups of lesser Jerahanai. Several of them shifted around with a larger machine gun on a tripod and opened fire, the heavy weapon chattering as it turned.
"Ah, this is more like it,"
Hecabe thought. Warriors just behind Hecabe fell, the salvo enough to wound or slow them down. But Hecabe continued forward into the shadows between two buildings where the humans hid, ignoring the metal slugs slapping off his armor. The Jerahanai chieftain burst into the humans' midst. He was energized to see their small, alien eyes open wide with fear as he appeared. From Hecabe's experience, humans seemed to expect their enemies to shoot back and find cover. They were always shocked by a charge into direct fire. They scattered before him, and rightfully so. Hecabe raised Oath of Fury and slammed it hard into the street. The sound of the hammer's impact echoed from every flat surface nearby, its gravitic energies expending violently in every direction. All around him, the bodies flew away and bounced off the building walls and ground when they landed. Many immediately perished, so close were they to the hammer's strike. There was a large splash of blood on Hecabe's shins. These so-called human fighters didn't even have real armor. They depended on their numbers and running away.
"Such easy prey."
"There,
Another one darted behind a toppled pillar the hammer had knocked over. The human was scrambling for safety, just like the barn rodents on Doysak.
Hecabe dropped the hammer on it and was pleased to witness a pair of bloody legs soar into the air and a head carom down the crumbling wall facades. His lips curled. This wasn't a full attack. This was barely a pack's worth of humans. He would have to discipline a Nexus later for his panic. If Hecabe didn't beat some sense into his subordinates, they would continue making mistakes. Being a leader was tiring work.
Hecabe looked around. Dozens of humans dead. The sound of their weapons had ceased. One of them, a male, remarkably still lived.
Blood streamed from its nostrils as it crawled slowly toward a fallen rifle. As the human grabbed it, Hecabe knocked the weapon out of its hands and picked it up by the throat. They were so tiny and inconsequential that he could hold this vermin up with one arm.
"You will know my name before you die, human. I am Hecabe, and you are nothing to me,"
he growled at it. The human did not understand his words, but kept struggling against his hold. It spat at Hecabe.
"Yes, that's good. I admire that. Fighting until the end. At the end of the Great Schism, when the human and Sangheili vessels attacked the ship where my pack's little ones huddled in a corner, I am told they called out for me and begged for mercy. Understand, they were too young yet to know the concepts of dying well as we do, human warrior. They did not know how to stand firm in the face of death. So they begged."
"Do you beg?" he asked, grinning in satisfaction.
"I do not understand your language, but you don't look like you are begging."
Hecabe increased the pressure on the human's spindly neck and listened to its angry sounds.
"Do any of you understand the human language?"
Hecabe asked of the other Jirohanai now gathering around him. Unlike the Sangheili, who thought it warranted to use translation devices to learn of the enemy's schemes, Hecabe had no plans on making any conversation with the aliens, just killing them.
"It tells you its lineage," a warrior remarked, "and its name. It calls itself Jaff, of this world's chieftain."
Hecabe lowered his voice.
"I see, and yet, even though I should be proud of the fact that my pack's little ones died in battle, all I can do is think about how frightened they must have been, whether they hoped I could still save them, of their despair. It should not haunt me, but it does."
The human struggled to dig its hands into Hecabe's arm. It gasped for air.
"There are no other chieftains of this world now," Hecabe announced, louder now. "There is only Hecabe."
And no more of his pack would ever again die at alien hands. Hecabe squeezed until the human's neck audibly snapped and the body slumped in his hand. He casually tossed the body into the rubble.
"Back to the dig," Hecabe ordered.
The outcome of this skirmish would certainly be enough of a message to the humans to leave the Jirohanai alone to their work.
Through his heads-up display, Jai looked at the incoming Sangheili spreading out through the hangar. The first wave of boarders had breached the ship's armored hull and were now opening its bay doors from the inside, giving dropships and other craft easy access to its energy-shielded interior. They hadn't spotted the Spartans yet, as they were standing still among the cover provided by the rows and rows of disused and partially stripped Covenant craft. Jai shifted the civilian's body in his arms slightly. They'd staunched the worst of her bleeding, but she needed real medical assistance soon.
"We need to fall back."
"No,"
Adriana said. Her recovered energy sword flared to life. Let's take that boarding vessel.
Jai could see from his cover at the end of one of the giant stacks of stripped Covenant parts that a ship-to-ship battle was taking place outside the hangar in the darkness of space, as brilliant flashes of distant light winked on and off. Point defenses of the Covenant ship they were on were still firing, stabbing plasma at the waves of Tick boarding craft looking to attach to its hull, and bore their way in. Chunks of debris from destroyed Covenant fighters and unlucky dropships tumbled about with every explosion.
Mike, Jai asked, a small note of frustration creeping into his voice.
There's a whole ship full of Sangheili on the other side of the hangar doors, Mike said. There are only 20 or 30 in this area. I think our odds are better here. I should be able to fly one of these Ticks, if we can clear the hangar and get aboard.
They were ignoring Jai's orders. He fought his annoyance as he ducked plasma fire, turning his back to it to protect the civilian, and huddled up behind a Covenant phantom that seemed to be completely sawed in half.
They've spotted us. What are we doing? Mike asked.
Jai's armored boots crunched the mechanical guts of the phantom that had been ripped out from under the dropship's armored skin, making it look as if it had been disemboweled. Frayed cables trailing out from the body on the nearby floor like grimy entrails. This area was more like a junkyard packed high with spare parts than a smoothly polished Covenant war machine.
Another puzzle to shelve away for later.
You said you should be able to fly the Tick? I don't like should, Jai said. I like can.
And Adriana had sounded determined but not confident about taking the boarding craft to begin with. They were throwing dice here. This was also a Tick breaching vessel. It wasn't exactly made for precise exfiltration maneuvers in a battle space. It was designed like a torpedo with a siege bore, specifically for launching at enemy ships, impaling their armor, and then burning them open for boarding actions.
Should's better than dead, Mike replied.
We're taking it, Adriana repeated as she clambered up over a nearby stack of dismembered wings. They'll put up a fight, but we can make it.
The two Sangheili who'd turned a nearby corner looked up as she dropped onto them, the enemy shooting wildly into the air at where she had been a split second earlier. She beheaded one of them with the energy sword. The other hit her with its shoulder, slamming them both into the hull of a decommissioned Seraph fighter. Adriana rolled out of the dent she'd made in the Seraph's hull as the Elite tried to fire its weapon point-blank into her helmet. Melted alloy splashed back onto them both as the plasma bolt missed and hit the Seraph's undercarriage, just a centimeter to the right of where Adriana's head had just been. Adriana spun around the Sangheili and climbed up its back, grabbed its neck with her free hand and forced it hard to the ground under her. The energy sword flashed as the alien hit the floor, while she simultaneously impaled it. It wriggled, screaming as Adriana leaned all her weight into the sword, the weapon burning slowly through its chest and down into the deck plating. Jai heard heavy footsteps adjusting course in the hangar.
Well, we have their attention now, he said. We take the Tick.
A Sangheili rounded the corner of several large engine pods stacked together. Adriana turned to look at it as Jai tensed. There was no way she could get out of the way in time before it fired on her. A wave of plasma fire hit it first. Mike advanced calmly with the carbine he'd acquired from the headless Sangheili. Adriana kicked the plasma rifle from the other dead Elite over toward Jai.
Okay then, the Tick, she said.
Jai picked the rifle up, then carefully adjusted the unconscious civilian so that she rested over his shoulder.
I'll cover.
Mike fell back with him. Adriana ripped the bay door off a Covenant phantom to their side, encircled by stacks of equipment. They stepped inside after her.
Jai glanced around at the gutted interior.
Is the ship we're on some kind of recycling barge?
He looked at a jagged hole in the opposite side, the result of an explosion that clearly had occurred long before they'd arrived.
Hold on, Mike said, coming in after Adriana. Check out your 3 o'clock.
Well, hello, old friend, Adriana murmured.
Jai,
It's Whiskey Tango Foxtrot 1.
The one and only, Mike said. It was their designation. Self-assigned. Not protocol.
Jai followed them back out of the Phantom chassis, being careful not to hit the civilian's head on the side of the hull. He glanced slightly right and saw what they were referring to.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot 1 was a battered UNSC Bumblebee. The Class 5 heavy lifeboat had burn marks all the way down the left side, but was otherwise intact.
For Jai, it felt like it had only been a few foggy, confusing hours ago that they dragged the cryo chambers and latched them to the inside of the escape transport. He could remember half-daydreamed snippets of doing that. Somewhere in a murky past life, the tension as they'd struggled to get away from a dying ship above the surface of a doomed alien world. A feeling that it was a long-shot chance at survival, as he waited to be frozen. And then confusion when they'd suddenly woken. Apparently almost 6 years had passed, like a bad dream. And now they were getting back aboard this death trap of an escape pod. Deja vu all over again.
"We all on the same page, then?" he asked.
"If we can get it up and running, there should be enough fuel for round two," Mike said. "The air brakes haven't been triggered yet either. We just used it to get off the Vicuna, not go planetside."
"I count four elites between us and the Bumblebee," Adriana said.
"We're going to be launching this thing out into the middle of a Covenant naval battle," Mike said. "But it'll pop out of here like a bat out of hell. I think we might be able to dodge the worst of it. The armor looks like it can still take a beating, as long as nothing too big gets slung at us. It'll certainly be safer for re-entry and planetfall than the Tick. Hopefully they haven't been stripping it apart like everything else in here."
"Okay. Let me swing around to flank the long-necked assholes over there," Adriana muttered. "Then we move. Run and gun until we get inside and close the door."
"It's a plan," Jai said, as Adriana leapt over a nearby pile of tubing and Covenant engine parts.
"Okay," Adriana said.
Now she actually sounded merry to go along with her determination, and yes, in this case, confidence. A better combination, Jai thought.
"Charge them."
Jai held the civilian's head to his shoulder with an armored gauntlet, trying his best to protect her as he shot the gap. He followed Mike out into the open, running as fast as he could for the Bumblebee. His thighs screamed in protest, skin still searing with cryo-itch as his feet dug hard into the floor. When the half-ton of Spartan got up to speed, he leapt up to clear the remains of a Banshee fighter and started firing at the first Sangheili he spotted. It gaped for a second, then dove for cover as its armor shielding flared. Mike and Jai both focused their fire on it until it ran for safety. Plasma fire exploded nearby, kicking up spare parts and sending debris scattering.
"Take out the farthest one. He's more accurate," Jai said.
Mike crossed in front of Jai as Adriana slammed her way out from behind a pile of discarded ship-mounted weapons and hit the closest Sangheili with enough force to throw him 15 meters back. The limp alien slid across the deck plating. A nearby Sangheili started shooting at Adriana. The shielding on her Mjolnir armor flared, but held together as she rushed to meet it.
"Don't chase them! Get to the lifeboat!" Mike shouted as Adriana rounded a large stack of scrap metal and disappeared.
Jai slammed into the side of the Bumblebee as Mike tapped on a control pad. The rear airlock door opened, drawing from the vessel's reserve power. Mike scrambled inside as Jai covered the open airlock door with his plasma rifle.
"Adriana! Where are you?"
Lights flickered on and a familiar hum filled the interior of the Bumblebee as Mike climbed into the pilot's chair and started the ready sequence. Something heavy clanged on top of the Bumblebee. Still holding the civilian, Jai crouched, aimed up, and stepped back.
"It's me." Adriana dropped down and jumped into the Bumblebee. "Spotted one of them with a plasma launcher. Thought I'd save us some trouble before he got us in his sights."
Jai followed her into the lifeboat. Mike glanced back, and once he was given the all clear, the thick airlock door thudded shut and hissed. Outside, the sound of plasma fire plinked against the hull as two Sangheili ran toward the craft. More would be gathering around them shortly.
Jai set the civilian into the chair next to him and pulled the harness down over her shoulders. She stirred, but didn't wake. He glanced out through the narrow airlock windows at the approaching Sangheili. The reinforced glass scorched as more plasma fire hit it.
Our buddy with the plasma launcher had a friend, so I borrowed their weapons.
Adriana held two plasma rifles up as she shoved her legs against the far side of the wall, just as Jai had done. The harnesses in here couldn't be pulled down over their bulky armor. They were designed for a small crew of average-sized humans, with a large rear bay capable of carrying things like a heavy weapons cache or a slipspace drive. Or a trio of Spartan-laden cryotubes. Mike looked back at them. Ready? One of the elites that had reached the Bumblebee was now battering an energy sword against the airlock door in the back, attempting to tear his way inside.
Go! Jai said.
The lifeboat's thrusters kicked on and blew the Sangheili standing behind it across the hangar deck. The Bumblebee screamed and screeched its way across the hangar floor, metal grinding hard.
Mike!
Mike tapped at controls to his sides, ignoring his teammates. The lifeboat bounced and then slapped the deck again. The scraping sound intensified.
We won't have any hull left if you don't stop doing that, Adriana shouted.
Don't interrupt the pilot. He's busy, Mike muttered.
The Bumblebee bounced again, then stayed in the air just in time to clear the carcass of a Covenant Phantom. Jai noted that Mike was trying to stay low so that the spirit dropship now breaching the atmosphere shielding at the front of the hangar didn't shoot them with the massive cannon hanging off its undercarriage. They wobbled again.
Hold on, Mike said.
The thrusters punched. The Bumblebee flung itself out of the hangar and past the spirit.
And cross your fingers.
Bumblebees were fast, tiny, and hard to track. But they weren't invincible. If one shot from a capital ship connected, they'd be a haze of glowing dust before they even realized they'd been hit. Covenant plasma fire crisscrossed the vacuum around them. Mike jammed the thrusters, changing their speed and course randomly, tumbling through space as he deftly navigated the dense field of enemy fire. For several moments, Jai waited tensely for a final explosion of heat as Mike skillfully piloted them through fields of dying Covenant ships, hulls carved apart and spewing debris and alien bodies out into the vacuum. He was using the chaos of battle to shield them, deliberately moving through the smoldering remains so that they could hide among deorbiting junk. I'm trying to home in on a beacon down on the planet, Mike finally announced, his voice ragged.
Hang on, I've got a readout here. We're above an outer colony world. Kero. The origin point of the beacon is a city called Subraka. It might be a leftover ping from before the battle up here started. It probably got hit hard by the Covenant, so we're definitely really far behind enemy lines. It's automated.
Wait. Someone's actually down there.
I'm getting some chatter, but a lot of it is encrypted and it's not standard UNSC. I think there are definitely people hiding out down there.
That sounds better than nothing, Jai said. He wondered if this was why the Covenant was here, to wipe out whatever human population remained planetside. There had been entire worlds where that had happened. The Covenant usually got around to finishing the job. The last message Gray Team had received from the UNSC indicated that Covenant forces had reached Sol and begun the occupation of Earth. Extinction was imminent. Jai wondered if humanity had somehow survived, or were they above the last pocket of human civilization right now? 6 years was a long time to be out of the loop. But here the Sangheili had clearly been fighting each other. What had that been all about?
I'm not even sure if I can get us there. We're on a bad trajectory, Mike said. Steep. But I don't want anything following us. We're going to take a real beating on the way in.
The air around the lifeboat glowed red with heat from re-entry. Curtains of flame crept up around them to hide the ocean and clouds of the planet below. Rajka watched the small human transport explode out of Unwavering Discipline's hangar as he thrust his energy sword into one of Tharz's warriors. The dead Sangheili slumped to the ground, The Spartans had killed another 8 or 9 on their way out. Rajka, another 4. The remaining enemy had fallen back to their dropships and boarding vessels to regroup. Cowards. Seeing so many of his foes' bodies around the hangar pleased Rajka. But it was shameful to see that so many of them had been killed by the Spartans, denying the fleetmaster and his crew the glory they deserved. And the Spartans' seemingly successful escape was a humiliating capstone atop the whole affair. Earlier, Rajka had anticipated certain death fighting the boarders. He had hoped differently. But somewhere deep inside he knew there was no chance Tharz himself would ever board unwavering discipline until Rajka was dead. So be it. But he would go down fighting just the same, as would Rajka's trusted inner circle. And while undermanned for a cruiser, the rest of Rajka's 1,000-strong crew aboard the Unwavering Discipline, the last ship standing of Rajka's once great fleet, were committed to battling Tharz to the bitter end. Still, the escape of the Demon 3 chewed at the back of his mind, pulling his attention away from the honor of a last stand. Before they managed to escape, he had come close to the human lifeboat but was unable to stop it. He had only enough time to toss a Malakos tracker onto the transport before he was attacked by enemy Sangheili. The tracker would tenaciously cling to the vehicle's hull exterior, no matter the duress. It would even survive re-entry. So once more, the Demon 3 roamed free. Grey Team, the envoy had called them when she tried to open negotiations to acquire them. Rajka had mostly stopped calling the humans Nishum somewhere near the close of the war. It had been a hard adjustment. He had been taught to follow the teachings of the prophets and the path of the great journey by his elders, since learning how to walk and hold a practice weapon. He had been a devout warrior from the earliest of ages. It had all fallen apart so quickly. When Rajka learned that the Sanshayum had betrayed their union with the Sangheili, stirring up a coup by the hands of the Jirohanai, it felt like his world had been cracked apart. Everything he had once put his faith in was ripped away. Rajka was demoted by the newly appointed Jirohanai leadership, stripped of his fleet and sent to the shipyards to take care of the old, damaged vessels. In that brief window of time when the Sangheili were thrown from the halls of power, and the Jirohanai took their place. Shortly after that shift in power, the Arbiter and his allies led a rebellion that turned into a full-blown civil war. The Great Schism, resulting in the end of the Covenant's campaign against the humans. Stranded in a band of ship debris being repaired around the Sangheili homeworld, Rajka had still believed. He still held to the prophet's words, hoping this whole controversy would pass like a bad dream. After all, this was their sacred calling, the cleansing war, their destiny. It was everything to them. But the covenant had really been torn asunder. And it was gone. Forever. Now everyone was still trying to find their own way in the aftermath. A new way, as the Arbiter Thel Vadam had pointed out in his pleas for all Sangheili to stand with him and make peace with humans. The universe held so much uncertainty, so much chaos. Rajka had welcomed the new leadership, even if he still longed for the old ways. Despite the lies of the prophets, the humans were just an intelligent species. Another civilization. That was it. Yet, that trio of Spartans, they would always be vermin to Rajka. Most Sangheili, no matter their allegiance or creed, could put aside all differences to see these Spartan wretches killed. For they were indeed demons. Humans, Rajka found, he could make alliances with. Once you really dealt with them, you discovered that they were cunning and resourceful, even if they lacked honor and resiliency. The Sangheili actually stood stronger with their new human allies by their side. But he had been utterly imprudent to leave the Demon Three alive in stasis, as if they were some kind of bargaining piece to be traded, looted off the remains of something he had once plundered in space. That was Kidyar thinking. A true Sangheili would have killed the Demon Three the moment the intel came in, confirming their location, and he found them floating in deep space, frozen and smug, helpless in the face of their own atrocities. Rajka had lost his world. He had lost his fleet. And within moments, he might likely lose his ship and his life. These things he could barely make peace with. But seeing the Demon Three escape burned away at him with an indescribable rage. His plan to die here would have to be postponed for the time being, Rajka realized. This could not stand. He contacted the command bridge. Armed engineering teams to the shield generators, he ordered. Restart the engines. I am returning to the command bridge. Ancients, judge me, he pleaded. But he had decided to forego glory. What Rajka desperately wanted instead was vengeance, fiery and pure. He would do this for all Sangheili. He was going to hunt down the Demon Three. For Glikki, he thought. He would kill them all where they stood. Chapter 6. An aide appeared at the door of Elise's temporary office in the bunkers deep under Soraka. Governor? He fidgeted for a second when he got no response. He pushed the door further open and tried again. Governor? Elise pulled the stim patch off her forearm, crumpled it up, and threw it into the trash can by the plastic desk. Just a moment. She leaned back in the chair, waiting as she rubbed her tired eyes. Then the warming sensation prickled the roots of her hair. Her heart sped up a beat and a flush crept up her face. Wakefulness returned. Okay. Elise glanced at the aide's name tag. Cameron. Let's go. Cameron led her out through the command center into the meeting rooms. We're in the middle of a war, Elise thought. And somehow I'm spending more time in conferences and sitting around than I ever have before in my entire administration. That seemed ludicrous. Surely she should be standing next to a commander near a field of battle, right? But no. There were the endless planning sessions, documents, and decisions that had to be made from the bunker. Lots of decisions. And Elise needed to be there for each one. She had to know what was happening, because she was responsible, in the end, for everything that happened to Soraka. That's what the people had elected her for, trusted her to do. Inside the meeting room, Elise looked around the conference table, frowning. She seemed to be missing two generals. Okay, General Grace, I'm ready. Where are Aru and Kapoor? General Grace looked up from reading documents on a datapad in front of her. They're resting. They were coordinating during the attack and never had a moment to stop. Oh. Grace nodded curtly at the documents. We now have a better idea of the Jirohanai strength and how far they're willing to press forward. One of Grace's aides had mounted a paper map of the city on the wall. This is how they had done this sort of thing hundreds of years ago. Paper on a wall in an underground facility. It seemed incredibly inefficient and impractical to Alice, but it was all they had right now. Someone had used a marker to shade areas showing the Jirohanai-controlled sections of Soraka, isolated on the border of the city and the vast Ult Desert. The rough headcount is about 300 Jirohanai on the ground, judging by the dropship intervals and spotter counts, the aide said. They're demolishing the buildings and using heavy equipment. Large, heavily weaponized excavation platforms, like the ones we saw during the war. Now that they've secured the area and airspace, They're using a legion of Ungoy to push the rubble toward the city. It may be some kind of barricade, we're not sure. We don't have any eyes in the sky at the moment. But some reports indicate they're leveling all the buildings in that zone of the city as well. General Grace added, They stopped our incursions, reacting very negatively whenever units passed the financial district and approached the residential areas. They did not pursue during retreat, but kept to the occupied areas marked off on the map. For Jiril Hanai, they were very organized about it. Usually you can lure them out with a three-person team. Decoy squads, designed to break up pack numbers. Two for firepower and someone posing as bait. They never took it. Step past the demarcation point, though, and they attack en masse and with extreme prejudice. Two hints in one statement about Jiril Hanai brutality, Elise realized. How many people did we lose testing their defenses? 20% casualties on units sent in before withdrawal, Grace said, grimacing. We're still sorting out the casualty lists. Lots of possible MIAs. Others deserters. Some of them are pretty shaken up after seeing these aliens face to face, and seeing what they're capable of. They certainly earned the name Brutes. Elise knew that General Grace had been offered a career track in the UNSC and could have continued a life back on Mars, in the UEG's population dispersal effort. Grace had no love for the UNSC, but many found a way to bury that in exchange for stability. Most people here in Soraka had considered building new lives back in Earth's solar system after becoming refugees, living on the Martian reserve for the first few years after the war. Any citizen here could have continued down that safe, comfortable path. But they'd come to Karo, many with children, so far from the UNSC, out here in the joint occupied zone where so many glassed worlds existed. They'd wanted a place of their own. Freedom from the wars of the past. From the UNSC's overextended control. Some believed the UNSC would eventually use the Covenant as an excuse to gain full military control of the colonies. All of them, including Karo. Conspiracy theory crap. But Elise had heard it often enough when campaigning for governor. Elise constantly reminded voters of the fact that she'd grown up on Karo and was 18 when she'd fled Soraka with her entire family, before the Covenant fleet could arrive. She'd been 40 when she returned here. Jeff had been born on the UEG's reserve, a network strewn across the southern dunes of Terra Samaria on Mars. Her husband, another refugee, had hailed from Arcadia. She'd met him in the camps. Her delayed engineering degrees, something she'd fought to get even as the war crept closer and closer to Earth, had been a defiant victory. Her return to Karo, yet another. How many casualties will we take if we try a full assault? Elise sat down in one of the conference chairs. We have 4,000 in the militia and 3,000 or 4,000 volunteers, right? Grace nodded, hesitant. We don't have any orbital support with our ships hiding out past the moon. If we tried anything of that nature, the overwhelming probability is that we'd be destroyed by the Jiril Hanai or Sangheili ships in orbit. It would be suicide. And if the enemy didn't have the high ground? Assuming some miracle. Or that everyone aboard the Sorakan ships laid their lives down to give everyone on the ground a chance. Hundreds of Jiril Hanai against our militia, and them armed to the teeth with fully weaponized ground and aircraft? Grace shook her head. I can't condone any manner of frontal assault at this time, even assuming the remote possibility the other ships could provide some support. The risk is simply too high. Elise sank further back into her chair. She'd browbeaten and shepherded so many toward her platform of reinvestment and ambassadorship. She'd worked hard to get negotiations between the Sangheili here on Karo, with the UEG as a mediator. All things the prior governor, Kate Adelaide, had chosen to delay, in order to first make sure the militia was built, the bunkers were dug, and Soraka was fully prepared for the worst. The Sangheili only had tens of thousands in the keeps of Rak. banding those together into something like what humans would call a city. Humanity outnumbered them by a million in Soraka. But the Sangheili were vicious fighters. Elise had viewed a potential war as tremendously wasteful. Yes, the Sangheili had landed 6 years ago and started building in the Ult, thinking Karo abandoned, only months before humans returned to re-establish Soraka. And yes, they were very territorial. But the UNSC hadn't protested the Sangheili colony. And in fact, some suggested that Karo was offered to the Arbiter's people by the UNSC to assuage their Sangheili allies in light of some unspeakable crime. What was more likely was that the UEG hadn't even had eyes on the planet at all since the Covenant attack years earlier. But once they found it, it would have only strained the tense post-war relations to demand that the Arbiter and his leadership uproot tens of thousands of determined warriors. So they didn't. And the first few years had been so quiet, Elise thought. You could even pretend that there weren't aliens living on the other side of the Ult. Imagine that somehow a sandy, impassable border protected them. Sure, people here grumbled. But it was reiterated by their advocates over and over that the Sangheili weren't like the rest of the Covenant. Their naval fleets had actually turned on humanity's enemies and fought side by side with people. Then, as time went on, more and more incidents had happened at the edge of the desert. Conflicts between human settlers and Sangheili. Maybe war was inevitable. If that was to come, she had thought then, let it be after humanity had grown in numbers and in manufacturing ability. Infrastructure, resource allocation, trade, everything that came along with a burgeoning human economy. She'd had the figures, damn it. 3 more years, and the Sangheili here on Kara would have been utterly unable to face them in any kind of context. Maybe that was why they had attacked now. Governor? Now people were throwing their lives away in probing defenses? So that they could ascertain the strength of this sudden Jirohanai occupation? And Elise herself had been the one who said they needed to probe those defenses, hadn't she? Elise flipped through the notes her aide had taken of orders she'd given, looking for written confirmation that she had actually suggested they do this. A few days earlier, she was working through plans to solve runoff issues at the base of Ardu Ridge. Now she was sending soldiers into a meat grinder to test enemy defenses. What could ever prepare one to be a wartime leader, she wondered. Nothing. It was a constant roller coaster ride of emotions, guilt, and fear. Governor, are you okay? Grace asked, concerned. There. There it was, on paper. She'd clearly ordered this disaster. It had just been words, though. Things that she'd known would be expected of her. Probe their defenses, she'd ordered. Figure out what's going on up there. But now, the blood was on her hands. This was all too messy. Elise couldn't see a way around it. People would die, no matter what choices she made. And if she choked, people would still die. There were only less bad decisions here. Elise looked up at the general and her aide, who were both staring at her. I just want them off our world, she whispered. Not just the Jirohanai. She meant all of them. I want them to go away. No matter which way Elise pushed the pieces around, they would not click into place. Not this time. Her entire life, she'd been able to visualize a project and make it all line up. Now there was just unstructured chaos, and those haunting, less bad choices in her head. The general glanced at the aide and back to Elise. We're trying to come up with solutions, Governor. Really, we're trying. Then we have to try harder, General. We have to push harder. We owe it to the people who took this journey with us to Kara, and who gave everything of themselves, General Grace rubbed her temples, letting her guard down for a second to show how tired she also was.
I know, Governor. Believe me, I'm feeling the weight of it all as well.
From the Unwavering Discipline's command bridge, Rajka Kassan watched his enemies scatter before him as his heavy cruiser accelerated, shields suddenly back up. Tharz's boarding craft and dropships sloughed off the hull, then spun and darted about fruitlessly as the fleetmaster shouted commands to ignore them. Daga had followed his orders to get the shields online. Loyal Sangheili had bled the decks slick, defending repair parties throughout the ship. Lives had been spent. Even now his crew kept fighting hundreds of intruders throughout its many corridors as the cruiser moved. And, Rajka swore to himself, it would be for a worthy cause.
"Is this a final attack on Tharz?" Daga asked.
He had not questioned any of Rajka's demands. No one had. The energy Rajka had returned to the command bridge with had galvanized all his officers. Something was afoot. The crew knew their fleetmaster and their Kaidon. Possibilities seemed to brim as they murmured to each other of Rajka's gambit, perhaps ramming the vessel into the traitor, or even going back to Sangheilios itself to return here with a greater fleet.
"No," Rajka said to his second-in-command. "Tharz is now beside the point. He does not matter."
Three enemy frigates turned and raked Unwavering Discipline's sides. Shields sputtered out once again. Rajka gave commands to spin the ship, spreading the damage out. Occasional bursts of plasma fire ripped through the hull. But Rajka was quicker. The belly he turned to his enemy's spear was always the fat, never the muscle. Let them pierce his decks, but leave his engines intact.
"Fire back," Rajka shouted. "Do not stand and gape at me, or I will strike you down myself to preserve your own honor."
"If we are not attacking Tharz, then what are we doing?" Daga asked.
Fear colored his voice.
"Are we running from him?"
Rajka gave Daga a hard look.
"Running? I am Rajka Kassan. I will not be tainted by cowardice. I want vengeance."
Rajka paused and looked out at the bridge crew. Only his most trusted officers knew about the Demon Three. He was sure many of his crew had been curious about why he had posted armed guards at that particular hangar bay. The quarantine held, however, and the existence of living human Spartans had remained a secret for most on Discipline.
"I would talk to all my crew," Rajka said, tapping at controls to initiate a shipwide message.
The ship shivered, struck again as Rajka nodded and began speaking.
"Some time ago, many of you wondered why I took this ship back to the ruins of Glikki, the world most of you had considered home. For 6 years now, since its destruction, I have left many probes in the system, watching, waiting, reporting everything. They found a signal, a human signal. On the borders of the debris field, a single human escape craft was found, and aboard, three stasis chambers. Inside them, we found the Demon Three, a team of what the humans call Spartans. They were held captive in secret on Discipline for a time, as I pondered how to exact their punishment."
One of the lower-ranking officers on the bridge gasped, eyes widening. Rajka continued,
"We do not run from Tharz. We chase the Demon Three now, as they have escaped this ship during battle, and with the human envoy's help. Tharz's attack and the envoy have stopped us from bringing the Demon Three to proper justice for what they did to Glikki, and I will not let them slip from our grasp again. Will any of you?" Now they all understood. Their eyes collectively gleamed,
Rajka looked at a single pip on one of his holoprojectors. We are tracking them. We will catch them. We will kill them. Only then will we again turn our attention to Thars. This is why I ask you to fight the borders. This is why you must hold the engine rooms and shield generators. The command bridge erupted in delighted roars of assent. Daga looked overcome for a moment.
I am with you, Fleetmaster and Kaidon. I pledge myself to this. I am sorry I doubted you. The demons will pay for the horrors they unleashed.
More hits. Damage reports rolled in across projectors faster than Rajka could even understand them. Is the slipstream drive available? He shouted over the barrage of plasma tearing his ship asunder.
One jump only, and we may end up in slipspace forever if we do it, Daga answered. We need just a moment to regain power. Thars hails you, Fleetmaster, the communications officer shouted.
Show him to me. Rajka looked up as his foe shimmered into being as a hologram in front of him. Cousin Thars. The easy, informal greeting should have gotten a sneer from Thars, but his enemy was too gleeful.
You run.
I am told your slipstream drive is being readied. I always knew you were a coward, Rajka. You are choosing to flee to Sanghelios. Back to where you are no longer considered a Kaidon. Anyone of consequence you seek shelter from there will strip your ship from you in shame, brand you a failure, and give you menial work for the rest of your days. Rajka shook his head. Thars, you and I fight over our visions for this world. You have come for my throat because you think I am weak. I understand this. Grievous error though it is. But Thars, you bear scars by my hand, for you have seen me fight. Even now you waited until you had more vessels and more warriors pledged to your cause than I before you would even dare attack me. You may gloat now, but look deep inside yourself. You know what I am. You know what I am capable of.
Thars appeared to quickly sober. Confusion played across his face.
Then what is it that you were trying to do? I hunt the Demon Three, Rajka said, and enjoyed Thars's stunned look. I had them imprisoned in human stasis chambers until your ill-advised attack released them.
I had heard rumors,
Thars breathed. He twisted his head slightly.
And you let them live?
I did. Thars remained silent, thoughtful for a moment. Rajka glanced at the engineering readouts as unwavering discipline struggled to prepare for its single, risk-filled slipspace jump.
Rajka, did you wish to use the Demon Three for trade?
I did. Thars waved a hand.
Unexpectedly clever of you.
But you waited too long. So, I will allow you to die with honor, if you tell me where they are. They will be like a thistle in a forest, cousin. Only I know where that thistle is.
You lie.
I have a tracker on their escape ship, Rajka said. Kill me and you lose it, and any hope of finding them. The last thing you want on Rakoi are three demons skittering about on its surface. No matter what happens to me.
I have as much right to hunt them as you, Thars hissed.
They slew all that I knew as well. You have made enough of a mess. It is time for me to do the right thing.
Rajka pointed at Daga. They didn't need to delay any more. Further conversation was unnecessary.
Slipspace, by my order!
Thars disappeared as unwavering discipline punched through the void, quickly launching through slipspace before emerging hundreds of miles away, trailing debris from the hundreds of jagged holes throughout the vessel. Rajka looked at the tracker's signal. It looked like the Spartans were heading for the human city, Soraka.
Down, Rajka ordered. Down toward the Spartans.
Our hull is damaged beyond repair, Daga said. We might not make it through the atmosphere. Our shields have fallen again, and we cannot re-enter without them.
Sir, Thars and his fleet are adjusting their orbit, an officer reported.
They come for us, Daga said.
To the surface, I said, Rajka shouted.
He found a certain calm in choosing his next command.
And inform the repair crews they have until we enter the upper atmosphere to get the shields back up, or we will all burn.
Hecabe sat on the remains of a concrete wall and looked at the growing pile of detritus the slave Ungoy were pushing up between the horrible-looking, burned-out human buildings on their perimeter. Some of the Ungoy utilized mechanized goblins, peculiarly designed heavy lift suits, which Hecabe allowed in limited numbers to expedite the process. They had bitten a large circular chunk out of the entire city now, reduced the buildings in the circle to rubble, and created a great crater out of the debris. Time was precious. He couldn't glass the entire city. He simply didn't have enough cruisers or opportunity to reduce everything around his underground target layer by layer. He needed to be precise, fast, accurate. But they could start glassing this particular area, and in mere hours, unveil what he had come here for. One of Hecabe's trusted captains, Taryllus, approached.
The Sangheili appear to have stopped fighting each other, he announced.
Rajka has fallen already, then?
Hecabe asked, surprised.
No. His flagship is coming down out of orbit for the planet's surface. Thars chases him.
Hecabe stood up, alarmed.
Thars would not approach until he has killed his rival. This is unusual. Do you think he suspects something? I would speak with him. Now!
Taryllus loped off toward the low-hovering troop carrier that Hecabe had been using as a temporary command center, with the chieftain striding close behind. Orders were shouted. The carrier's Jirohanai attendants ran around looking for a holotank, and moments later the three-dimensional image of Thars stood in front of them all.
Thars, why are you coming to the surface?
Hecabe asked, attempting to mask his unease. There was, after all, nothing in their compact that allowed Hecabe access to this world, and he had assumed the Sangheili would have battled it out above the planet for some time, giving him the window he needed to accomplish his purposes.
I go where I please.
Thars looked haughtily at Hecabe.
And that is none of your concern. What are you doing? Why has the battle ceased?
Hecabe seethed at the dismissive tone in Thars's voice, but had to relent, as he too was in the wrong.
Enjoy your time, Sangheili, Hecabe thought. We will see if you speak to me in such a manner as I tear you apart. I do not answer to you,
Hecabe growled.
I pledged ships to help your cause. And yet you are invading the human city.
Thars seemed to lean in closer, the hologram wavering.
This was not part of our agreement. I should ask, what are you doing there, Hecabe?
We agreed to give you weapons and ships, not a piece of our world.
Shall we discuss this right now? Did Thars suspect? Did he know? I have business on this planet, Chieftain. I have holdings on this planet. That is why I agreed to our partnership. So now I am coming down, as is my right. I will not explain anything more to you, and I will deal with you in good time.
Thars waved a hand and cut off the transmission. Hecabe slammed a heavy fist down into the holotank, cracking its casing.
Tell the cruisers in orbit to begin the attack on the Sangheili. They either suspect something or are on their way to interfere.